This week's podcast is brought to you by Massive, the fastest way to send and receive massive video files. Send uncompressed dailies, locked pictures, DCPs, and more with Massive. Keep listening to hear how you can receive 100 gigabytes for free towards your next transfer. Welcome. My name is Matt Jepson, and I'm a DP working in Sydney. Co-hosting with me today is my good friend Dean Frisky, an Australian commercial director and longtime collaborator. We're joined today by Mark Toya, a director based in Brisbane and world-renowned for his commercial work. We'll be talking about Mark's debut feature film, a self-funded sci-fi thriller called Monsters of Man, which features some kick-ass visual effects and killer robots. Monsters of Man has done very well since it was released at the end of 2020 and is now available on Amazon Prime, where it currently sits in the top 10 action movies. Welcome to the podcast, guys.
Sweet.
Howdy. Good to hear you.
Toya, are you escaping that weather up there right now? I believe there's a cyclone circling in that area.
Yeah, there is. Well, north. Yeah, no, it's missing me at the moment, but it'll, I've just left a little island paradise up there, which I'm sure that's going to get affected pretty quickly over the next couple of days. But down here in Brisbane, which I've just landed, it's okay. But I'm sure it's going to pour all over us, and I'm shooting next week, and it'll probably destroy our shoot. like all that.
That's never happened to you, Dean, has it?
Never, no.
I actually haven't had too many weather days in my 20 years or 25 years I've been doing it. I think I've had three in 25 years that have literally shut us down. But, you know, it does happen.
Are you a Queensland native?
No, I'm a Kiwi.
You're a Kiwi?
Yeah, I'm from New Zealand. So, if you can hear a little bit of Kiwi accent, that's where it's come from. And I have been living here for 35 years actually. I came over kicking and screaming with my parents when I was around 14.
Mm-hmm. Mm. So we can claim you as our own then?
Until I do something wrong, yes.
Yeah.
The reason why I wanted Dean to be involved in this conversation is Dean is primarily a commercial TVC director, and my background is as a documentary and commercial DP. And Mark, as many people know, is a renowned commercial director as well. And so this being your first feature narrative film, mm-hmm. This seems like an interesting transition. And we have some questions from the perspective of someone coming from commercial work that maybe enjoys narrative or wants to get into narrative and how that transition worked for you. So, Dean, do you want to kick off some of these questions?
Yeah, for sure. I think that, well, let's start right back at the start. So you've been at the top of your game for a while, and I'm just curious about the genesis of this. Is this one of these ideas that's been in the back of your mind that you've been writing for, you know, 20 years? Or was it one of these things that, you know, maybe 3 or 4 years ago you wrote on an airplane or something, you know, just came to you and you went, I can make a feature film. Like what was, yeah, talk us through that.
It was pretty much the latter. I did always kick around the idea of doing a feature film. But the more I looked into it, you know, from a business perspective, the more I walked away from it because I couldn't see a logical way of doing a movie without the hangers-oners, you know what I mean? The creative mm-hmm. hangers-oners. And also I couldn't see I couldn't see a business side of it that was actually safe. So as you both know, I mean, I'm sure you both know that, you know, with whatever you want to invest in, whether it's property or anything, you're right, there's got to be a fair bit of calculation in there because you don't want to, you know, if you're going to spend $1 million, say, on a house or an apartment block or a bit of property, you want to get some sort of return off that investment over so many years, right?
Mm.
And, you know, if you can pull 5 to 10% out of that investment, per year enough to be able to pay its way or at least pay off its loan that you might have attached to it over 10 years,
mm-hmm.
it becomes then a calculated risk. So from my point of view, doing movies, I always looked at it and I went, there's no guarantee that you're going to make your money back making a movie.
Yeah.
And that's a bit that always pulled me up each and every time. I go, well, okay, where is the – there's no calculus to it. There's no proven way of making movies and getting your money back. There's no solid ground for it. There's no foundation for making movies. So every time I did it, I just pulled back pretty much straight away once I started digging deeper. And the other bad thing too is there's so many people I know that have made movies. There's so many commercial directors that have made movies, so many movie directors that have made movies.
Yeah.
And they're all still living under their mum's house or, they're still paying back friends and they've lost a bunch of friends and yeah. Their investments. It's a lot of them have not done too well out of it, you know what I mean? Quite a few movies sitting on shelves.
Yeah, right.
And so what I've done, even though the poor buggers have made mistakes doing it, and I may have made a big one out of this one as well, you've got to learn by other people's mistakes. All directors, luckily, we all get on so well that they're quite open with sharing all those facts with you and where they probably made a mistake, where they went wrong or who they jumped in bed with or what they could have done better. So, you know, over the years I've learned a lot from those guys and we're all still good mates and they're watching me right now go a completely different angle again.
Yeah.
Hoping that I either win or lose. I don't know what their wants are. But the thing is, the math for making a movie never stacked up. It's not a very reliable horse to be jumping on. So from for this particular project, for instance, you know, did I think of it 4 or 5 years ago? Yes, I did. I was literally in. I did have a couple of scripts beforehand that I was toying around. Again, every time I started doing it, I started changing my mind. This particular time, I was in Vietnam, and I had a friend of mine there. He said, look, I'll pay for it. You make it. And I go, oh, great.
Wow.
Because, he was a wealthy businessman in Vietnam.
Mm-hmm.
And I was in the middle of doing a project with him, and he trusted me that I could do a decent job. So, and he was going to go and try and sell the movie himself.
Mm-hmm.
But anyway, what happened then is we were going through it. He was moving to Canada at the time. He had some financial issues. I'm not sure what they were, but he rang me up and said, Mark, I've got to pull out. And I go, okay, no, that's fine. I didn't want to put any pressure on anyone.
Mm-hmm.
But I sort of had the wheels turning, you know. And then my wife said to me, well, why don't we just do it ourselves? Because I've managed to keep the value of the price of it down.
Mm-hmm.
And then, you know, because my wife and I have been doing property for many years.
Yeah.
And we thought, look, if we treat this project like we treat our property.
Yeah.
And we'll do the same way, right? We won't think of it as a movie. We'll think about it as a piece of property.
Mm-hmm.
And then we'll try and sell it like a piece of property and we'll rent it like a piece of property. We'll do everything like we do normally and just treat it like an emotional creative thing that we've made, but more like a block of flats.
Yep.
So we went in with that angle and that's how we started it. And that's how we decided to make a movie.
Wow. So was that less the – like what I find fascinating about that though is that like before that, did you ever – in thinking about – was that business – the business side of it always on your mind or were you ever thinking – I guess we should probably step back a second because you are a bit of a Renaissance man, the fact that you can do – you do a lot of things. Like you're a pretty capable person. Like you can amazing DP, great director, but you've got an amazing handle on post as well, and the things that you can do on your own. So, was when you were thinking about making a movie, was it also about being able to maintain control over that, as opposed to I'm going to make a movie, or I'm going to make a write a script or make a short or whatever, and see what doors I can get opening up elsewhere so somebody else can pay me to make the movie. Was that ever a consideration, or was it always I want to be able to maintain control and be able to build on that investment over time? Was that always a consideration?
It was a bit flexible at the start. I was open to outside investment, but I knew every time an investor did want to come in, all of a sudden they were thinking, oh, there's a part in the script I didn't really like. You know?
Yeah, right.
There was this and that and that and this, and there's a spelling mistake on page 13 and stuff like that. So you just sort of like straight away I knew there was going to be a thousand more conversations put in place if I – that's an investor in at this point in time. Yeah. Now, look, before I go on too, I'm not saying that doing a movie with investors is a bad thing. If you've got no money, you want to get your project done, you've got no other choice. You know, yeah. If you want to try and get tax offset money, your tax break money, and then reinvest it back in your film, or you want to keep it, if you want to get grant money from the state government, you know, Adelaide or South, you know, Victoria or Queensland and New South Wales, they want, you know, you want them to inject into your project, you know there's going to be a lot of input, all right?
Yeah.
This is what it is. You know, are they going to say, well, you can't say that word and you've got to put an Indigenous person in it and you've got to put three females and you've got to, you know, it's all going to get washed.
Yeah. And you're going to have to shoot a certain portion of it in this country or that country.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah. And they're going to say, yeah, it's going to be very Australian. You know, and the thing is, that's what happens when you get free money, right?
Yeah.
And, you know, I've got a friend of mine doing that right now. He's going through it. He's got, well, he had a fantastic script, but now he's going through that channel. He's like, every single page has blue marks on, like, all over it, right?
Yeah.
Every single page is, you know, you can't use that word. And yes, well, that word is what was used in those days. Yeah, but you can't say that word now. So all of a sudden his script and his movie is now a shadow of what it was.
Of what it was, be. Yeah.
And he's going to make it. Now the movie's, as well, because you got all these, all this free money comes in and they demand certain things. And all of a sudden, his movie is now costing three times more than it should because of those demands. So these are the things, you know, and there's a lot of hoops that he's jumping and he's going, but the sad thing is he's going backwards at the same time. So I feel like you know, if you've got the money stashed aside, that's fine, but make sure you don't put the house on it because you don't want to risk, you know, hard-earned dollars and not get your money back.
Yeah.
You know, I think, you know, before you take someone's money, you've got to look at all the byproducts that come from it, you know what I mean? And especially when you go to sell that movie, there's going to be a lot of pain after the fact, you know, after you finish the film. Or, you know, you finish the film, then people are going to get involved in the edit. They're going to get involved in everything. When outside salespeople come in, they might want to re-edit your movie and take this bit out and that bit out. And, you know, the movie's quite a – when it's a lot of free money and people doing pre-sales and people investing early in that movie, you can guarantee it won't be your creative expression is what you wanted from the start of your project, you know what I mean?
Yeah.
It will evolve into something – maybe completely different, and you will become you because you remember the only IP that you bring into it is maybe it's your idea.
Yeah,
right. You've got a scriptwriter that's probably going to, you know, jump around and cause a bit of chaos. You've got investors that have a stake in the game. So what happens is the director or the owner of that idea become the lesser part of the dollar equation. So what happens is you might get people that come in with 90% or a whole bunch of investors come in with 90, 80, 100% maybe of your full total investment. Yeah. What is your investment in the film other than the idea? All right. So they have the right now to really dictate a lot about that film, the way that film has to be made and sold, because they are the ones that have put skin in the game. You've only just put a little bit of an idea in the game.
Yeah, you're essentially an employee from that point on.
Well, you turn yourself into one pretty quickly.
Yeah.
The hide
out. So then In terms of, so in with your, with Monsters of Man, then do you feel that you've 100% of your creative vision, like that's you there? Were there any compromises along the way for you in your journey?
No, I think the lucky thing about this whole process and the way we did this was I only had to answer to my wife pretty much. So with my wife, she just said, you just got to make sure you don't go over budget. Well, you know, yeah. I went over budget because I changed my mind halfway through. But the thing was, I knew I only had X amount of dollars and a lot of knowledge, right? So I go, right, I can shoot, I can direct, I've got all my own equipment. I know how to do post-production.
Mm-hmm.
I know how to put this together pretty easily. And it's not like it might look hard to do from, you know, when you watch the movie, but the reality is after 25 years in the ad agency or in the ad game, making TV commercials all around the world with crazy deadlines, I knew how to put this together with one eye shut. So it didn't faze me at all from a production point of view, from a shooting point of view, working with actors, everything. I learned nothing new from it other than, wow, this thing can drag on, right? All my energy then could go to the backside of it, which is selling the film. And that's where I've put a lot of my mental energy is, all right, if I'm going to make this product, let's go down all these different traditional and non-traditional routes of being able to sell this movie, because no one really wanted to buy my movie off me because I'm a non-commodity, right?
Mm-hmm.
As a director, no one knows me as a full-time independent film director or producer.
Yeah.
No one wants to take a risk on you. They don't know who I am. So it's just.
Sorry, this is before you'd finished making the movie. You're talking about this as a script.
Before it, during it, after it.
Yeah, right. Wow. Okay.
So just to be clear, you're planning the distribution plan before you've even shot the thing?
Yes. But I'm looking at multiple angles at the moment. So when we finished the film, we had some really good contacts, over the years.
Mm-hmm.
And I got sucked into, I walked handsomely into, I met up with a really good lawyer in the States, Stuart Rosenthal was his name. And he's a bit of quite the player in LA. He knows everybody, right? Now, he convinced me in a good way, and I'm not going to disrespect him at all because he's a great guy and a good friend and we'll do business forevermore. But anyway, he goes, his way is the true Hollywood way, right?
Yeah.
So you get yourself the biggest agent in the land, and that agent, don't get the little agent. He said, make sure you get into the top three or four agents in America. They will then, because they know everyone, present your movie to the biggest players in Hollywood or the biggest distributors, which they did. So we pitched our movie to, firstly, our finished film or almost finished film, you know, to CIA, WME, I can't remember the others, but, you know, all the big agents that represent film directors and movies and all that.
Yeah.
Now, it ended up being quite a bit of a little fight on it because people saw the movie and they went, wow, shit, that's amazing. That's really good, actually. Where did this come from? They were really excited as well. They took it to market. Now, these big guys don't need to go to markets, right? They don't need to go to CAA, to France or anything like that, right?
Yeah.
This is the big boys club. They just ring up their mates and go, look, like CAA, for instance, they have a huge theater in their offices in LA. They invite all the major players. They all come and watch my movie, and it all looks very positive. They literally stayed, and they told me, said most people will only watch 5 minutes and walk off. They said that people stayed right to the very end and watched the whole thing to the end. They were like really transfixed.
Wow.
They all came out. And then the bids started coming in straight away, right? So
mm-hmm.
There was the 200,000. We'll give you 200 grand for America, and we'll give you 300 grand, 500 grand, $1 million. And it was all getting beat around. And then we thought, But they were hoping that the movie was going to sell for like $10, $20 million, right, to some of these players. But see, this is where the problem stems, right, because I'm a nobody with nobodies in my movie other than robots, right? I did have Neil McDonough in it, but he's not a big enough player to be pulling big bucks, right? He's not Brad Pitt.
Yeah.
You know, as good as he is, as well known as he is, as well respected as he is, he still doesn't pull a dollar. I mean, a strong dollar. He just gives your movie some street cred per day, you know what I mean? And I'll put him in movies forevermore too because
he was great.
Really like him as an actor. He's a fantastic guy.
He did a good job.
Yeah.
And the thing is now after that relationship with him, working with him, he loved working with me also. And now he wants me to do stuff with him, you know, because he just really liked the way we worked together.
Yeah.
And how fast I was.
Yeah.
And how good I made him look, you know, and that's an actor thing, right?
Yeah.
I want it to be easy and it's just got to be fluid and we got on really well. So anyway,
another story. How many days did you have with Neil?
I only hired him for the day.
Yeah.
Wait, what?
Yeah.
And thought, oh, this is very ambitious. But, you know, I didn't even start till 9 in the morning because I was a bit jet lagged. You know, I'd strolled in and then we had a nice big lunch and then we ended up shooting 10 pages without blinking an eye, you know, and we finished them up at 6 o'clock, shook hands, put them in the limo and sent them home.
Brilliant.
And he was like in awe. He couldn't believe it. He was ringing me on the way home. He was ringing me the next day. And he said, that's the fastest, most efficient shoot he's ever been on in 200 movies, you know.
Wow.
He was like blown away. And he says, the stupid thing is I look awesome in it. And and he's seen the whole film now and he's like blown away by even what we've produced. So now he wants to produce films himself and he knows what I'm capable of, you know.
Yeah.
And again, this is a story of, you know, this is another thing about the movie is I'm not too worried if the movie doesn't make much money. It's actually my calling card.
Yeah.
You know, that, and this is what I'm going to rest my future of movie directing. So every single producer really that has seen, that have reached out to me and watched my movie have actually all offered me movies.
Yeah, right. So
direct for them. Because now they know, right? I'm now on their radar. They look at it and go, oh, my God, that looks amazing. And you made it for how much? You know, that old question.
Yeah.
And away you go.
I just have one question about Neil. You had him in for a very short day, it sounds like. Why are you so efficient? Does that stem from being the director DP and kind of knowing when you have it and not having to translate it, or is it something else?
Look, I've already got in my head what I want, and I think that's, you know, visually. I visually already know. And I always shoot multiple cameras as well. In multiple cameras, shooting, you know, in this case it was only him, so I just ran two cameras on him, right? But in running two cameras on him, it becomes a one-take situation. If you want to chop between cameras, you don't need to just do take after take after take. The other thing too is when you cast actors, you just got to make sure you don't have to hand feed them, right? Like actors that don't know their lines or actors that struggle with their lines will become a major burden for you on set, a time burden. Because what happens is they might ruin a great big performance for another actor per se, you know what I mean?
Yeah, yeah.
And you really need to make sure those actors are on point. And even if they don't know their lines 100%, it doesn't matter that they forget a full stop or drop a letter or they reconstruct it slightly in their own way, so long as they have the start and the end is the same and the same duration, you know what I mean?
Yeah.
I'm okay with that. But they've got to be – but they've got to make sure that they don't throw other actors off. And the good thing with Neil, when you're doing a single actor just talking, you know, just he's reacting to things on phones and friends and all that, like what Neil was doing, it's easy to shoot out 10 pages of that in a few hours with two cameras. It's actually not hard at all. So it's not like I mean, some people can turn that into something very hard. But the thing is, he knew literally that whole script when we turned up. I didn't have to feed him any lines. I said, all right, now we're going to do, and I have a look, and I had all my sides for each and every single piece. We had part of the movie edited. So he looked at the movie, right? He got it, looked at his page, and he goes, okay, done. Let's do it.
Let's do
and
it.
Off we went.
And professional.
Every single time. And I go, look, let's try a little bit like this. And then sometimes he would say, you know, I reckon I could do this. You know what I mean? Like,
yep.
He was watching this thing and he loved the actor, Kruger. Kruger.
Mm-hmm. Yep.
Beard, right?
Yeah, he was great.
And he goes, I really like this guy. This guy's a great actor. He goes, I want to work with him a bit, you know, within the scene. And like he goes, I think he said something like, you know, and make sure that fat fuck doesn't slay you, it'll get in your way or whatever. Yeah. I mean, he was just dropping little lines like that. And you know what? I just let him do it because, you know, you need to have a little bit of spontaneity on set and you need to have a little bit of creative movement there so you can fart around. So,
yeah.
He did every one of my lines exactly the way I wanted, and then he threw in probably another, say, 30 or 40% on top, you know what I mean, of extra stuff.
Yeah, yeah.
And I took it all because I just thought, well, why not?
Why not?
While I'm editing, I had to go, oh, that works really well. So by the time we got into the final film, I think I used 15% of what he gave me, you know, which he just sort of ad-libbed, and the rest was from the script.
And that's why you get professionals, you know, because they just they give you the cream on top, don't they? They just lift it to another level that you never expect on the page. So
yeah. And the other thing is there's a lot of actors, big-name actors, that, and I won't mention any names, but that I've worked with as well, just on ads and stuff. But you go, well, they don't remember a single line. You're literally hand feeding every single line. So I know now if I was ever going to do the movie, I was never going to hire them because they just drive me nuts. Even though they might be nice guys, it might be fine, but an actor that doesn't know their lines and they're not prepared and they haven't got their character prepared and you're like trying to motivate them every time, you're trying to put them in the, you know, they're relatively lazy in a sense, or maybe they're not capable, right? They're just famous because they are, not because of their acting skills. So, but anyway, that's something that I made sure with all of my cast, I made sure my casting was really tight and I just made sure that every actor was on really got into their character and really knew their lines.
Did you have rehearsal time with every actor or did you do anything remotely in advance?
No, I didn't. I didn't want to. I did more, I'm going to call it psychological evaluations, right? Because when we did the casting, I sent all the actors a letter and it was pretty much saying, if you're socially retarded, don't come. Do you know what I mean? Because it's going to just kill everything. Yeah. Meaning I needed someone that was going to be adventurous, brave, strong, committed, focused, you know what I mean? I didn't want someone to come in and be a cancer with the team, you know what I mean?
Yeah.
The other actors, I didn't want there to be the painful prima donna egomaniac on set.
Yeah. Because
that's what happens is very quickly on all sets, and you know it yourself, you guys have been shooting long enough, you get one person in there, can literally poison the whole place pretty quickly, you know what I mean?
Yeah.
And then as a director, I'm spending so much time trying to put that fire out all the time. So now my mind is not part of the creative. It's now pushed towards a single individual.
Yeah.
And again, that will burn time and it'll start compromising your creativity. So what I did before, as I was casting, I got on the phone with each person. I was just asking them about themselves, who they are, you know. Do you like running through the jungle in Cambodia and get tripped over a rock and breaking your knee? You can handle that, you know. If it rains,
how do you respond to that question?
You know, are you okay to be standing in the mud for four weeks? Are you happy to eat Cambodian food for a fortnight? Are you, you know what I mean? You want to know that these people will go, fuck yeah, I'm into it. Do you know what I mean?
Yeah.
You don't want anyone that hesitated, I just cut them. Straight off, like you're out.
So how many people did you, in terms of, so I'm sure you, you know, I'm sure you had a short list or even maybe even a long list, but like what percentage of those people, you know, that you were interested in ended up you having to go, yeah, no, you're not, you don't fit the, like, you're just not going to, if you're not willing to do this, you're just not going to be good for the shoot. Like,
well, that's what, see, when you have a good casting agent, that you give them the rules first, right? And they've got to, they've got to tell them. Or that, like I said, this letter that we gave or everyone that cast for this film,
yeah,
I wanted them to read that letter first before they even cast, or we did a lot of self-tapes.
Yeah, right. Okay. So that was your first filter before they even started sending in their self-cast. Yeah, right.
Yeah,
okay.
That's right. And look, for some reason, when we did the casting in Australia, there was a lot of painful actors in Australia, because I'm not sure why, but they think that this is the way Hollywood is supposed to act.
Yeah.
There was a lot of agents that were very
painful.
And it was it was just Australia. It was, you know, and I went, and there were some good Aussie actors there, but their agents were letting them down, right? Once the agents started, you know, wanting to banter with me and make things, you know, they're just trying to push you, right? And I just cut them, gone. And then the actor would ring up, what the hell happened? And I said, oh, your agent's a pain in the ass. And sorry, maybe the next one. And they're like, fuck! You know, but it's just the way it is. I wanted a nice, simple, easy, painless exercise through this whole thing.
Yeah.
And the last thing I needed was pain from an agent or from an actor that was feeling like they were famous, you know what I mean?
Which is probably – that's but you obviously had to compromise for the boy who in this – like, I can imagine he would have been a total pain in the ass, which is fair enough because he gave an amazing performance.
Oh, the young kid?
Yeah, yeah.
Oh, no. No, he was incredible.
He was. Like, I'm just wondering, like, in that performance when, you know, in relationship to his father, like, what did you, like, was it, were you saying, you better cry, otherwise I'm going to kill your dad? Like, what was it? Like,
no. No, definitely not.
This is what's going to happen, okay? Either you do this or this is what's going to happen, buddy. Yeah.
No, not at all. So that little kid was we cast that little kid from Cambodia, obviously.
Yeah.
Now, he was part of an orphanage. It was like we cast a whole bunch of kids from that orphanage, and they were all fantastic kids. And the reason why we did is the lady that was helping us over there, Kulika, she's a line producer. She goes, the orphanage kids, they want to be better in life, right, and everything they do. Where the kids that were with families and mums and dads, they were too looked after. Do you know what I mean? They didn't want to run into the bush. They wanted an umbrella over them. It was all too hard. Where these kids have grown up quite tough. Quite hard.
Yeah.
And to come on a movie set, all of a sudden it was amazing, right? There was food there all the time. There was looked after, transport, clothing, everything. And so these kids really put everything into it without me even asking, because they wanted to be great. You know, this was like a dream for them to do anything like this. And so that particular child, Lee Tai, you know, we had all the kids and it was more about, you know, I talked to all of them and they could just speak English, so a lot of it was through translators.
Yeah.
And the other thing too, I made sure I paid these kids the exact same we pay the Americans, you know what I mean? Yeah. The poor little, you know, we're not going to rip no one off. Everyone will pay. Through sadly the orphanage probably has to disperse that money the way they deem fit, but my wife and I are literally going to go back to Cambodia and figure out a strategy, because we'd like to help that kid's education at very least.
Yeah.
Get better and better over time. So we're going to make sure that young fella's looked after. I mean, anyway, let's go back to his performance. So he read through the script with the translator, who was a director as well.
Mm-hmm.
We went through and they knew the scene. And we knew that you know, because he's an orphan child, his dad was actually murdered, I think.
Oh, God. Right.
As well.
Yep.
I'm not sure if you witnessed the murder. Yeah. But
there's something tangible there for him to hold on to.
Yeah. So, you know, we went through the role with him and said, this is what happens, and da-da-da, and he got it. You know, he's sitting there looking, he's nodding his head, he's taking it all in. And I said, look, just do your best, and we'll do it in pieces, and we'll, you know, just so you can, you know, in other words, I was going to shoot around his inefficiencies because I didn't know how great this kid was going to be. He was very attentive. He was great with his lines. He was doing everything I asked throughout the whole movie, but this particular scene was a very powerful scene. And I just had no idea if he was going to be able to pull it off. So, we sat down with the line producer slash director slash translator, and we're going through and we're talking about this and this is what can happen, and, you know, Dad's going to die, obviously, from the gunshot, and you're trying to protect your mum and him, and, you know, it's all gone wrong. So as good as you can, how would you react? He goes, I'd be very upset. And I go, yeah, I know, but what I would like you to do is you portray the way you would like to fulfill this role, this scene, how you'd like to make the scene come alive. Anyway, it all happens. We got four cameras on it because I just didn't want to torture this child if it went crazy, you know what I mean? So we had four cameras on him, on the whole scene, and off he went. And he did it in one take. and there was tears, and I was literally on a camera bawling my eyes out watching him.
Yeah.
And I was going to call cut so many times because I was thinking, oh, the kid's being broken right in front of me, right? And then I had another operator really close, and I looked at him, he looked at me, and there was tears rolling down his face as well. There was tears in the third operator. But the actors were crying. The guy laying on the ground was crying. I had to paint his tears out. He's supposed to be dead and he's crying, right?
Oh, my God.
It was such an emotional thing. And I thought, enough's enough, and I called cut. You know, I got to the end. And I went over, I said, Leaf, are you okay? And he looks at me, he goes, yeah. He goes, is that good? Is that what you wanted?
Oh, my God.
I'm like, oh, I said, I need a rest. I said, I'm just like so emotionally drained. Wow.
Yeah, it was so.
He goes, do you want me to do it again? I said, are you okay to do it one more time? I said, we won't do it too many times because I'm not sure you can do it twice, right?
Yeah.
He goes, oh, no, I'll give it a go, right? So this time I just moved all the cameras in a bit closer because I had to pick up other characters, you know, as well. Because we got all our mids and wides and a couple of tights. Now it's all very tight. And he knew that too. I said, now I'm going to get right in there, you know. And he did it again, carbon copy. And I was just like, oh, my goodness, this kid is unbelievable.
Wow.
And, yeah, two takes done, finished. And he comes over and he looks at me, and, you know, he's rubbing the tears out of his eyes, and he goes, was that good? And I go, that was awesome. And he grabbed a soccer ball and off he ran and started playing soccer with his mates.
That's amazing.
It was amazing. And to this day, I doubt I'll never get that, experience again, probably. I hope I do, but it's to see a natural talent that good, you know.
Yeah, lightning in a bottle.
Yeah, I lucked in. Anyway, actually, he was awesome. And since he was that good, I just put him even more so in the film, you know.
Yeah.
Really got that character really working with Mason and his mum. And, you know, really he became a far bigger role in the movie because he was just showing this professional performance showing this real performance that – you don't really get with kids, you know.
Yeah. Well, look, it was interesting because I was thinking that I guess you've answered this question before, but like there seemed to be this theme that, you know, children are the future, and, you know, to have this child who is essentially saving these adults almost from themselves. And I was wondering if there was any, you know, pressure from, you know, investors or anybody else to make it a PG-13 movie, but Obviously not. No. That was a joke. That was a joke, by the way. That was a joke. No, obviously, it would never be a PG-13 movie. But yeah,
there was, I was even contemplating it myself to do a PG-13-14, you know what I mean?
Yeah, right. Okay.
Because, again, it's part of the whole commercial vehicle, right?
Yep.
But I thought, no, hang on. Now, this movie's going to be for me, this one. There'll be plenty of movies that I'll be doing for other people that are for them.
Yep.
And PG-13 and kids' movies and all that sort of stuff. And I'm more than happy to do that and stick to the rules. But I just thought, no, this one's for me. I'm going to make this movie that I like. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
But it's interesting because it's, I wouldn't classify the film as horror, but there are moments when it dips into what I would consider to be a horror film. And it catches me by surprise every time it does that.
Well, that was actually my plan, because I thought, you know, if this movie has to be commercially viable, right, and horror is a huge box tick, you know, when you're selling a movie, thriller, big box tick, action is a big box tick, you know what I mean, or sci-fi is another one. So what I did is when we wrote the idea, when we did all the script writing and everything, I just made sure that I didn't just make this an action movie. You know, I wanted it to be an action horror thriller, blah, 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 blah. Because I'm a small town, you know, director with you know, a very ambitious movie. So I'm going to try and target it towards as many genre fans as possible. And we have successfully, because I never... You know, you could see it when we sent the trailer up. You know, we sent it to horror sites and end up with millions of views, you know, and just normal action movie sites, millions of views. You know, it was really grabbing each one of those genre markets really, really well. And we've just finished a Red Band trailer for, you know, the horror market. And that's truly focused at that horror crowd, even though it's not supposed to be a horror movie, but there's enough in there to give them a little treat where they go, oh, my goodness, you know, that was like quite shocking, a few things, you know.
There are some very confronting scenes with gore and violence. And so actually I had some questions about some of the practical effects, because it seems like a post-production, like a visual effects movie. You know, the robots are certainly beautiful visual effects, but there's some amazing practical effects in there too, I think. Talk to me about how you handled that on set in Cambodia.
Which particular...
Well, you've got when the one guy steps on the landmine and dies.
That was a mixture of both, right? So that particular one, because we didn't have our normal pyrotechnics explosion guys, we just use the local guy in Cambodia that day in, day out, what he does is he blows mines up, real landmines.
Wow.
That are still scattered throughout the country, right? So they collect these landmines each day and he has to dispose of them. And so he was super, super safe. The good thing about hiring him is that no one was going to get hurt. You know, he was really, you know, we're at, you know, I work with a lot of, explosion guys, and they'll make these things, and I go, wow, you know, one day someone's going to get hurt with one of these, you know what I mean? And a lot of people have, a lot of stunt people have been injured in movie explosions, you know. Even though they're relatively safe this day and age, it's still an explosion. In our case, I didn't want to risk anything, so I didn't need an actor leaving with something that might have shot into his eye or because it's still debris at the end of the day. So what I did, I thought, well, I'll get this guy to run towards the camera, and right at the moment, he's just going to fly backwards and land on a mattress that was hiding in the long grass. Done. And everyone laughed. Oh, that looks stupid, you know. But what it was running on was an actual charge that was there. So we defuse it, obviously, so it'll never blow up. But it's still got detonators in it and everything. And then we go, okay, get out of there. So he races over towards us. We make sure the area is clean, and we just shoot the plate. Boom, you know, it blows up. And what I do, I just merge the two plates together because it's all shot within a minute or two of them each other, so the lighting's exactly the same.
Yeah.
And that's how we did. We just sort of merged them together and did that, and that was our explosion. So when you see him laying there and his leg blowing off, obviously that's if you dig around on my Facebook or wherever, you can see his leg is just his leg's just normal. And we've got I just found a company because I was trying to do it myself, but I couldn't get the blood just right because I'm not a great liquids guy. Yeah. So I thought I found a company, I think, in Czech Republic.
Yeah.
That were really good at fluids, and they did a whole lot of stuff for Die Hard. And I liked the way they did the bloods in there. Oh, no, sorry, in Rambo. And anyway, they just painted the leg out and just did it their way. It was affordable. It was only like, I think they charged us $1,200 or something.
Wow.
So you probably had blood makeup on him, but just the leg was what got replaced, or did you paint the blood on afterwards as well?
Yeah, only on his stump did we do it in post, and all the meat that was lying around on the ground near the crater, all that was done in post. But himself, we had a prosthetics guy on set that did all the prosthetics. On, you know, it was burns and all the torn skin and everything on set.
Yeah, I mean, some of those injuries looked really, really good in close-ups. Like the makeup was fantastic.
Yeah, it was. There was a guy, Jeff, his name is, Cabal, I think. I can't remember, but it's this guy was so awesome. He was out of the Philippines.
Mm-hmm.
He came in, you know, big swinging dick, and he was talking himself up, and I thought, oh, well, we'll see. But he could talk. He honestly was probably the best special effects makeup artist I've used in my life in 25 years. I mean, I've used some big, big guys, and they will sit there and they would have spent 4, 5, 6 hours on that actor. This guy did that in like 30, 40 minutes.
Wow.
And he turned. I remember when the actor walked to me, I went, oh my God, that it looked like it was really burnt. And I thought, well, because we're shooting 4K up close, macro time, right? And I look really, really close, and I'm going, oh my goodness, you've even got blood coming out of your skin. How is this even happening, you know?
Yeah.
And the guy did it as well. There's an old man walking through the cave.
Yes, the blind man. Yep.
And I just found him, actually. He was a priest that was walking through the cave.
Yeah.
And I thought, oh.
Wait, like he was actually just walking through the cave that you were filming in?
Yeah. And I said, hey, do you want to be in the movie? And he goes,
oh, what?
So I said, well, we'll give you some pocket money. Go over there. All you got to do is do your prayer, because he had this prayer that he chants as he walks through.
Yeah.
He was a priest, actually. And he walked through, and yeah, we looked like we had him all slashed up, you know?
My God, because I looked at that and thought, it was one of those, it was such a, it's this moment of the outside world just kind of creeping in. We've never seen him before and we'll never see him again. Yep. And I honestly thought that you had found somebody who had that done to his eyes and to his face. I thought that's the way he was. I didn't think that was makeup at all. Yeah. That was amazing.
And I'll tell you how amazing it was when this guy turned up and literally did that, all that makeup, like 20 minutes, right? And he came up to me, the priest, and he looked with the makeup artist, and I looked at this guy and went, oh my goodness, it looked like he really cut him with a knife. I said, how are you actually getting the dents in his skin? And he goes, oh, you know, the makeup artist is as smart ass as he was, you know, but he's a lovely smart ass.
Yeah.
He goes, if I tell you, I have to kill you, you know.
Yeah.
Like, all right, you know, there's tricks of the trade, right? But he did it. Again, I could be so close. I didn't see any. There was no problems of shooting macro.
I want that guy's phone number, like, because it was seriously. That's amazing.
If I can drag him to Australia, I will. I mean, I can't. I'll try, because he is world class. This guy is unbelievable.
I've done some filming in Cambodia.
Mm-hmm.
When it comes to lighting, how did you go with power and, you know, like what was your lighting like out there in the jungle?
It was really difficult because I didn't take any. So the whole movie we didn't shoot with any lights at all.
None. The whole movie.
Natural, yeah.
Wow.
Oh, actually,
what?
I'm a liar. In the cave, we had a couple, like two or three of those cheap little, $50 LED thing.
Yeah,
that we stuck in the holes. But reality is, no, the dead truth of it is, I just made sure every location I shot and chose, and each time of the day, I just made sure I shot at the perfect time of the day and the right time of the day, and found locations that just had beautiful natural light coming through. That I decided there was going to be no lighting.
So, I mean, you must have had a bunch of bounce and modifiers and negative and that kind of stuff as well, though, right?
Not a scratch of anything.
Mark, you are pulling my leg, man. Come on.
No. I've showed my movie to, again, a couple of very big DP friends of mine that do nothing but tentpole movies, and they were... They said, what lenses did you use? And I told them, and they were like, oh, my God. And they said, what camera did you use? I said, oh, my God. Who lit it? And I said, well, no one. It's natural. And they're like, oh, my God. You know, like they just, like, can't believe it. And they're, and these guys are, like, seasoned pros, right? They just, you know, one of them pretty much won an Academy Award. And again, I'm not going to tell you who it is, but they're all, they're all aghast as well. And I said, well, that's, you know, there's nothing wrong with shooting. There's a lot of great movies that are shot naturally, you know what I mean?
There's nothing wrong with that. But the, I guess the difference is that in my position as a DP, I'm often asked to recreate light or extend light or lengthen the amount of time that we can do something in a given place. And I guess if you are the writer, director, DP, you have a little bit more control over, well, I'll just not do it here, or this isn't working, so we'll flip the scene and do something else, you know? Yeah. You know what I mean? So how often, maybe that's a good question, how often did you have to modify your day to work with the light or work with rain or solve some kind of noise issue and just, like, change the scene entirely?
It was only one day. No, sorry, two. No, one day, actually. It was quite a long scene. It was in front of the hut. The Keeler's hut, you know, where the bad guys came. And there was a big standoff with the whole crowd. So we were,
this is early in the movie, right?
Yeah, early in the movie. It was about 15 minutes in or something, where they were confronted by the drug guys, right? And the drug village guys. Now, that scene, that took all day, actually, to shoot that out, because there was a lot of people that didn't know how to act, right? You got the guys that never held a gun in their life, right, in this village. There's a couple of actors that just had no idea about lines and how they need to come across. So it was quite a bit of work in getting certain things to gel and work in there to look natural. So what we did, we started shooting in the morning, because what I always try to do when I find a location or a setup is I always like to try for a backlight type situation or a side light situation. I don't like front light. And I wanted to make sure I didn't, break my line on any of the cinematography and the dialogue. And what was happening is the sun, you know, by the time the sun got to like 10 o'clock, you know, from an 8 o'clock start, all of a sudden all our light was starting to get shit, just turned to crap. So instead of shooting that scene out, I asked my first AD to bring us back, and we shot the next half of that scene in the same light the next day, you know what I mean? So that was the only time that we had to do that.
Wow.
Yeah, in the cave it was okay. It was dark, and we, at the time when, you know, the Heliums and Monstros weren't out then, we still had the Dragon cameras, but Jared sent me one of the prototype, one of the early Heliums to use, which I ended up having to shoot up a good portion of that whole cave stuff with a single camera, which was driving me fucking bananas, and it sort of dragged.
Was that just for the ISO or what?
Yeah, just for the ISO. Yeah, because the helium could eat up the dark nicely, but the little dragons were struggling, right? But just having that extra couple of stops up your sleeve was a big benefit. And I didn't really want to bring, because the moment you start bringing in light and you haven't got the correct lights, it just starts looking like shit. So. I ended up with one camera and a lot of that, which dragged out the day. But those were the only little things that I modified through the 50-odd days that we shot there.
Wow, 50. So the schedule is 50 days.
Yeah, it was 47, 48 days in Cambodia, and then we shot a few days in New York, a little bit in Canada, and some visual effects plates, some action fighting scenes with the robots here in Australia.
Yep.
We just shot in the studio,
Modern filmmaking runs on massive files, and massive files call for massive transfer. Spelled MASV, Massive is a file sharing solution for those who want to move heavy, uncompressed videos through the cloud without limits. No subscriptions, no complicated IT setups. Massive's pay-as-you-go model is designed to ship big files in record time at 25 cents per gigabyte. All you need is an internet connection. And now Massive has been assessed by the Trusted Partner Network, which means your files will never end up in the hands of would-be hackers. Sign up for Massive today using massive.io/AOTF and get 100 gigabytes free towards your transfer. That's massive.io/AOTF for 100 gigabytes free.
How did you handle the international shoots? Was that second unit stuff, or did you go there for that as well?
There was a lot that we shot in New York, actually. We shot the Foster. We shot him in a penthouse there just next to Empire State Building. Which creeps in a shot every now and then. There was more wider shots in there, but it just felt like Foster needed to be a little bit more intimate. So we probably didn't need to really spend that much money on a big penthouse after all that, because I just didn't end up using those shots, you know. They sort of looked great, but they weren't right, you know what I mean?
Well, it's interesting. I think that, I think that was a really smart choice, because it makes him feel he's kind of like an anonymous character. The fact that he isn't so, his situations and so specific, he really feels like he could be any one of those corporate titans, which makes him all the more dangerous in a way. So
he's more menacing.
Yeah.
Yeah, well, and he was a really solid actor too, and he had the cool deep voice and all that sort of stuff. And he was a real pro too, and I was sort of fumbling around doing my wides and mids, and I was like, fuck the wides, you know. By the time once we got going, I realized he was better, you know, just
close
shots and chests and heads and stuff like that. But, you know, we had him in the limo, and we drove around Times Square and all around 42nd Street, and, you know, doing all the car stuff. I just hired a big limo truck, you know, a big limo four-wheel drive,
Hummus
or whatever it was, and we just drove around and we shot all his internals there. Then we did a little bit with Jason Diamond, actually, in Times Square. We shot him in there, and
that was a fun cameo. It was nice to see him pop in. I had no idea, and I was like, oh, the fuck, come on.
No, well, we got there, and I needed a hitman, and I was actually casting for a hitman. And I thought, fuck, he's only going to be in it for like 2 seconds. You know, I go, fuck, I'll ring up Jason, see if he wants to be in it. And Jason goes, yeah, what the hell? And he didn't want any money or anything. And I said, I'll just take a couple hundred bucks and a handshake, you know. But he was fine with it. He didn't care. He just wanted to have fun and hang out with us, you know. I think I hired some gear off him as well. I'm not sure. I can't remember. But no, he was good and he was perfect. And because, him being a director himself, he knew he knew what I was after. Do you know what I mean? Yeah. It was that dark, really don't talk much type of guy. You know what I mean? Keep it simple. The typical, hitman that just rolls around New York killing people for fun.
So I do have a question. Like, you've got New York. Why New York? Why Cambodia? What drove these location choices?
Well, I wanted New York in there regardless, purely because of the scale. It gives a great production value to the movie, right? Just that as a city, you know. It's I just think it's nicer to shoot in than Georgia, for instance.
Yeah.
So you get the big
instant production value.
Yeah, and then I wanted to fly in, you know, into a city. So we hired the chopper with Jose from Gotham, and we hired a second helicopter, and we chased that helicopter in, and we landed down at Wall Street there. And it was just a nice touch, because I just thought from the opening credits, I just want right at the start, I want people to go, ooh, geez, this looks real deal, right?
Yeah, scale.
And it didn't cost a fortune to do that. And I thought it was a nice start to the film, and it gave it a bit of bit more of a global feel, you know what I mean? And I did want to make sure that this guy was a bit of a fat cat in a big city, you know what I mean?
Yeah, makes sense.
I didn't want him to look like he was in Sydney. You know, Sydney, blah, blah, Sydney, you know. Sydney's fine, but I just didn't want it. I just go, fuck it, I'm going to go straight to the top. Let's just go to New York. I've shot 1,000 aerials around Sydney that, you know, it's so-so. Nothing beats the scale of New York. And shooting in New York is really easy too. So, you know, some people think it's quite hard, but it's not. There's a law that's been there for many, many years, a shooting law, where if you're under 5 people, you don't even need a permit.
Yep.
I think, you know, a lot of people know that. Or if you do get the permits, it's very easy to get because they're so used to getting those permits. And, you know, shooting in Times Square, other than all the RF noise, which is going to kill your microphones and everything, we had just hardwired into Jason and to get the audio because, you know, the noise, obviously, with radio microphones in New York is almost near impossible to find a clear channel.
Well, what people don't know about the Diamond Brothers is that they're actually robots. And so when you say hardwired, he just has a headphone jack that you just jack it right into that. It's a mini XLR, actually, kind of a throwback to the first Red.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah, sorry, instead of radio mics, we just plugged in. Yeah. We even flew over our sound guy because our sound guy was so great in Cambodia. I just wanted to give him a little bit of a gift as well, to say, well, come to New York for a few days and let's go and shoot New York. But we kept our team pretty small and pretty lean. I've got Michael Gomes to run second camera.
Yeah, he's great. I like Mike.
Yeah, well, I like him too because he shot with me quite a few times around the States and because he's so fast and fluid and he knows, I don't have to talk to him much. I go, well, there's your angle. That's the lens. Make it look good. See you later.
And that's pretty much – well, that's my relationship with Matt, I have to say. We just don't talk much.
Yeah, that's really by choice, though, I think. Seems to go better. I did have a question, though. Did you write Cambodia into the script or did you write it for generic jungle and then go and find the jungle?
It was always going to be generic Golden Triangle, all right? So we were either going to shoot in Vietnam, Laos, Thailand, or Cambodia, anywhere in that region. So I decided Cambodia because I did a recce there and I went, wow, there's quite a few really great locations here that were too annoying in Thailand, similar ones, you know what I mean, mm-hmm. and too expensive because Thailand's very film-centric.
Yeah,
they know how to charge you. Vietnam was really good, but it was very limiting on a couple of other locations I was going to. I needed, and Cambodia just seemed to tick a lot of location boxes, and the cost was fair. You know what I mean?
Yeah,
and or the good thing with shooting Cambodia as well, or anywhere in Deep Asia, and I call it Deep Asia because we're out of the major cities, was the you could feed your crew for under $10 a day.
Yeah.
And they're all full. You know, I mean, they can't eat anymore. And
as the
well,
food's amazing.
And 2 beers and a leg massage all in the same, and all for the same $10, right? So, and you stay in accommodation, which is really good accommodation for like, pardon me. Sorry about that. You get really good accommodation for, you know, like anything from $50 to $100 a night. You know, it's really a cost efficient place. So just shooting there alone saved us, a couple of million dollars by not shooting it in Australia.
That's amazing. Mm. So we would be remiss to not talk about one of the best looking things about the film is these robots, and they look fucking great. Like they look really, really, really good. How did you know that you could make them so good? Did you do tests before you even got into production? Like what? I'm such a, you know, not digital guy. I like to do things in camera because that's the only thing I know. And so when I look at those on screen, I go, I can't even imagine how you got there.
Mm. Well, I think, look, one good thing is when you know how to do post-production, at a high level, things become easy very, very quickly. And the robots were no difference than doing a car, a 3D car or a 3D watch or a 3D anything, right? So, you know, we've done commercials where we've done full CG cars for the last probably 10 years in ads where people thought we had the car, but the reality is the client hadn't even finished making the car yet. And we'd run around and we'd just shoot a dummy car with tracking markers on it, and then we'd put the new car on top. And that was headlights, everything, you know what I mean? The whole lot of cars, wheels moving, everything.
And, but you did that in-house or you hired that out trusted people?
It allows us to do a lot of that stuff. But I just know over the years, even what I've learned over the years as well in 3D is, you know, once you've got a great UV, I'll call it a texture map, for instance, or great textures and a great photographic libraries, you know, with all the right dents and scratches and all that sort of stuff, you've got good HDR models, you keep your lighting really simple, the same as what you would out in the real world. Don't overcomplicate the way you light and grade and composite that model. You'll be amazed of how good it looks straight up. Okay, so where it all started was before we even made the movie or shot the movie, I wanted to make sure we had a design underway. So I knew what was going to be fitting into the Cambodian forest, you know what I mean? So I went through about three or four different designers because I know that I could probably model myself, my own robot, but it'll take me forever because I'm not a modeler, right? I'm quite fluent in 3D, but I'm not fast at it. And because I don't use it all the time, I'm not a post house. I just do things in 3D that I need for my commercials. But if it's anything really big, I like to farm it out to a proper post house that's got 30 people sitting there ready to work on it, you know what I mean? Instead of me sitting there for 3 months doing it myself.
Yeah, so totally.
In this case, I found a designer. Where was he? The first guy was in the States. But he was giving me so much attitude, I ended up cutting him. He was just like, it was all of a sudden becoming his robot, not mine. Do you know what I mean? Then a guy from India put his hand up, and he was great, actually. He had some really amazing designs, but he had no idea about engineering, you know, how things move. Like, he designed something that looked so awesome as a still image, but this thing couldn't work, you know what I mean? It would just fall apart if you tried to move an arm. And I was getting so frustrated with him because I'd be educating him about hydraulics and pneumatics and that, because I'm from an engineering background.
Right.
And I used to work with a lot of heavy machinery in my early days.
Right.
And a lot of robotic knuckles and hydraulic, you know, swivels and all that sort of stuff. So I was quite fluent in a lot of that stuff already. So anyway, he started giving me a lot of grief too. So I went, this is getting out of hand, right? Can't find a designer that really knows in industrial things or engineering. They're more about the look, not the functionality.
Yeah.
And then I was literally skimming through Pinterest, I think. Okay, no, they call it.
Pinterest
library type thing. And I found this robot in there, and I went, wow, this guy gets it, right? He gets how things move. It still wasn't perfect, but he understood how a basic engineering works. So I reached out to him, and he was a Russian guy. Now, we pretty much designed this robot together through Google Translate. I couldn't understand Russian.
That is awesome.
Blah, 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 and I'd send it to him, and he'd send it back, and good old Google Translate would just, you know, we had to do everything literally over email.
That is awesome.
So anyway, I showed him all the things I liked from models that I found around the world and robot styles and drawings that I'd made and all that. And he came back with his first draft, and it was very Cold War Russian, you know.
Yeah.
But it was cool. It was really fucking cool. So really, he had a really good idea of where I needed to be. And I needed to fit within the shoulders, elbows, knuckles of a real human because I wanted our animators to track it, the human underneath, right?
Yeah.
And I had to make sure that the ergonomics of these robots were the same as a human. So in joint position. So what I started to do then is we went away and we did the shoot, and I didn't worry about the design just then. I thought, well, the look of it looks right. It still needs work from a engineering sense, but I'm really happy with the basic look of this thing so far. So we went and shot the movie, all good and done, came back, edited it all up, and then we started it was about 6 or 8 and 10 months later, he comes back with a new robot. Well, it's actually the same robot, but he got rid of the whole Cold War thing, right?
Yeah.
It went really industrial because I sent him a couple of shots that I really liked, and I said, look, see the finishes. There's bits of carbon fiber in here. There's a whole bunch of exotic materials. I said, notice the hydraulic rams and the way the rams work.
Mm-hmm.
I said, but another thing too is, you know, let's rig it basically and we'll see what clashes. So when you rig a robot, for instance, and you want to just curl the bicep up, you know, like you're just doing the muscles, bicep, mm-hmm. the forearm, the metal of the forearm was smashing into the bicep. So yeah. With a human, those two can squash together because we're just made of, you know, fat and tissue, right?
Yeah.
But as a hunk of metal, it didn't work at all. So then we had to design these cutaways in there so the forearm could actually slip inside the bicep. So then I go, well, if that's the case, this particular joint here. So I sent him a joint that's part of a robot knuckle joint, which is a hydraulic knuckle joint, and it's called like a 217X or something part. You know, I sent him a photo of it. See, this knuckle here would work really well on that elbow. Because as it goes out, it noticed that it extends as it moves, which will give it 10 millimeters. And then we won't get the clash. And also the tubing and the hydraulic power is built within the knuckle. So that means we can get rid of the hoses because he had hydraulic hoses that went down the top.
Yeah.
So we'll lose the hoses and we'll just use that and we'll pipe the oil down through the bicep, you know, but internally. And he got it. You know, once he understood how these knuckles and particular things worked and these servos and how I wanted the hydraulics that were, you know, around his stomach, you know, I said, get rid of all the rubbish he had. I said, it all looks great, but it would never work in real life. So let's work it off a double tripod, inverted and upside down tripod system in the hydraulics, and we'll work his whole stomach area using these hydraulic rams. And then we did that, and the neck would work for that too. So then we reconstructed the whole neck system with the whole hydraulic system as well. Anyway, a long story short, it took about 12 months of fiddling back and forth.
But it's interesting, though, the amount of thinking and detail that goes into the construction of that. I can imagine that. Yeah, it's easy to look at and go, yeah, they just kind of, you know, whacked a model together and it's pretty, without necessarily recognizing the attention to detail that's required to kind of, because one of the things that really does sell the robot, aside from, you know, the compositing and the texturing and all of that, is the movement. It's the animation, like the way that they swivel, like you said, from the hip and then the head turns. That's a 12 months well spent. Like, congrats, because
they were major characters in the film, and I didn't want to fuck it up, right? So,
yeah,
you know, the amount of sci-fi movies that get made, and the poster's shit. You know, you go, oh wow,
yep,
really let down by that. And I just didn't want anyone to question a lot of this. You know, there's a couple of ropey shots in there which I wish I fixed, but the reality is there's probably more ropey shots in a Marvel movie, to be honest.
Yeah.
You know, because there's so many and then they're just smashing it together by the end. But I just thought, if people look at this, I want them to question it. Is this robot real? did Toya make this thing or is it free? Yeah. And, you know, there's so many. I was listening to a podcast the other day about, you know, it was just people reviewing my film.
Yeah.
And these four people in this podcast all thought we'd made this robot for real. They'd heard a rumor that we'd made it for real.
Well, and like had somebody wearing it on set?
Yeah. It, you know, and we were using sticks and we painted the sticks out and all that sort of stuff, you know. It was a really interesting thing because one of them had heard that we had Weta make the robots, right?
Right.
And but I actually reached out to those guys over there and the price that came back was like astronomical. So I thought,
yeah,
won't even go there. I mean, the price of the robot was actually more than my whole movie.
Wow.
Yeah. And so look, the reality is I just thought, screw it. It's a bit more than just designing the robot, right? So once we had the robot designed, made, I then took that robot, I fed that off to two different people, a rigger and a texture guy.
Yeah.
So again, my texturing is pretty good, but not as good as the guy that we got on it. So he really got in there. I showed him a whole bunch of samples of wear, and we built 12 robots by the end. At different levels and stages of their evolvement, running through the bush.
Yeah.
A few more bullet hits, scratches, explosions, all that sort of stuff. So they slowly, they slowly get a bit more dented and messed up as the movie goes on.
Yeah.
So what we did is he made the one robot and goes, well, here's all the scratches and everything like that. And the good thing about 3D is you can move the scratches around only a little bit and it's completely different, right? You just have to slide the scratches around a touch. And I said, I want to have a lot of wear on the corners and all that. And there's plugins now, within your renderer and within 3D now that you can wear a corner of a bit of metal really easily without actually doing anything with the UV map.
Yeah, right.
It's just a plugin now. And they look really good, all these wear marks.
So what did you do the 3D in?
Maya.
Yeah, right. Okay.
Yeah. So all the textures were done in Maya because our whole pipeline was a Maya pipeline.
Yeah.
And the only reason it was is because we had our animation team that we found in Vietnam and they all were using Maya. So we originally were going to go, Cinema 4D and then we just couldn't find enough decent artists on Cinema 4D. So then we went over to Maya.
And I guess once that, the byproduct of all this is now that you've now got the functioning plans for an AI robot that you can sell to the CIA. It's perfect.
In fact, I want to take it one step further. I'm going to start another rumor that this is a documentary. And this is actual robots and you just follow them through the jungles of Cambodia.
Yeah, we just chase them around. Yeah.
I'm cognizant of your time and we need to talk about distribution.
Yes.
You've got a fairly unique distribution plan.
Well, I'll do the basic, I'll keep it short and sweet, but very pointed. So obviously we didn't sell our movie. Actually, when we went through the CIA angle, and they were good lads, good company, we just didn't get the dollars we hoped. And we did get a big deal, a seven-figure offer from one of the big distributors over there. But we didn't like the contract. The contract was very one-sided and very long-winded. Yeah. And it didn't really suit us, or Carol and I. And because Carol and I, again, you got to remember, if we were desperate for the cash and I was really busy and all that, we probably would have dumped it and walked away. But the reality is, we didn't really need the money and we didn't need the headache of dealing with this particular contract on, and it wasn't enough anyway.
Yeah.
So the reality is, making the movie, I could have got my money back quite quickly on it, but I, before we even sold it, before it even was out to the world, but we didn't, we felt we could have probably done better and we just thought, well, screw it, we'll have a bit of a crack and do it our way.
Do you mind if I ask?
Decided to do it our way was because I then had control of marketing, I had control of everything, and I can then use this movie also as a publicity tool for myself. you know, for me moving forward. When you sell a movie to a big distributor in the States, you technically got to walk away from everything. And you've got to ask their permission if you want to promote it. Does that make sense?
Oh my, yeah, because it's their product. So for you to be, it's
yeah,
it's a bit like saying, "Hey, I'm going to put my own, do my own director's cut, and put it up on my thing, on my site, blah blah," without asking.
There's a lot of rules with a lot of these big contracts, right?
Yeah,
And you don't get carte blanche to do whatever you want, even though they're going to make all the money. And then we worked it out that what's going to happen is that selling it through these guys, the movie would probably do quite well, but I wouldn't see much of it. Do you know what
yes.
I
mean? Yep. This way, you're talking about the back end in terms of, like, obviously there's that up front, but then in terms of the back end there.
Yeah, the back end, I probably won't see anything.
Yeah.
And if I sell it my way, the movie will probably make less money, but I'll make more overall.
Over time.
So that was the way we weighed it all up. And you know, the company that offered us the seven-figure deal, you know, the good company, they've been around forever, it was just the deal was too rusty for us. You know, we knew they were going to sell it first and get it out in the marketplace, and they were going to make some money, and then they were going to finally pay us. Do you know that?
Yes,
there we go. Well, if you're going to take the movie, why don't you give us all the money and then go and sell it? You know what I mean?
Yeah.
But that's what we weren't really happy about that. So I just said, thank you very much, and we moved on. But that's a traditional way of selling it. So what I end up doing, we decided to go down an aggregation route. And we used a company to help us put it up on 9 platforms, which was like Apple, Amazon, Fandango, InDemand, Google. Google Play, YouTube, blah, 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 you know, the rest of them. And out of that, I was going to completely 100% then have control of the marketing, which we've done. And so this first stage of sales, because there's 3 stages that we're going to go through. The first stage is transactional video on demand, or PVOD or TVOD, whatever you want to call it.
Yeah.
And that's where we rent it. Rent it or buy it. People rent or buy it. You know, for $5 or buy it for $20 or whatever.
Yeah.
And that's going to go for about 3 to 4 months. And then we've got a SVOD strategy, which we then will probably rent, say, to, you know, the Netflixes, the world, Hulus, you know, all the TV stations. You know, we'll just push it all out like that.
Yeah.
And that's when you get, you know, you get a bit more money through your SVOD sales. And then you can put it on SVOD Amazon as well yourself, and you make a percentage per minute or per hour. You know, like I think they might pay you like 11 cents every time someone plays the thing for half an hour or something, you know.
Yeah.
And that's ongoing. So after that whole thing's all done, then we're going to put it in AVOD, which is advertising video on demand, and that's like Tubi. So Tubi will let people watch your movie for free, and what the people that advertise within your movie, you get a percentage of those advertising costs, which is pretty much the same as YouTube.
Right. Yep.
So that's AVOD. Now, the good thing about those 3 TVOD, AVOD, SVOD systems over 12 months is over the next 25 years, these are always going to be there.
Tripling
away. Do you know what I mean? So it's up to me now as the property owner to make sure that we create enough buzz, fanfare, advertising around it, because not everyone's going to know my movie even exists.
Yeah.
So even though we've had quite a good amazing success, for the movie as an indie film, now we've like number one on, iTunes and Google Play and certain genres. We were number 2 in Apple there for a little while. We were number
That's
1.
Incredible.
Like we were up there, we're sitting up there with Tenet and Wonder Woman either side of us. You know, it was amazing. So we had a really good start. And I think just on Amazon in the first, you know, 2 or 3 weeks, I think we got something like, I don't know, I can't remember, like 5 million minutes of viewing just on Amazon, which equated to like $250,000, I think.
Wow.
Rentals. And that was only one place, right? So things like that, so things are moving. So it's going through quite quickly. Now, the other way of distribution too is we're also doing territory sales, you know, foreign territories.
Yeah, like, right.
To Taiwan, Japan, France, Germany, all that sort of stuff. So, you know, we've made several hundred thousand dollars doing it that as well. Do you know what I mean? Directly to markets.
Yeah.
They're probably going to dub it and put funny voices on it and all that sort of stuff. And the movie, we'll sell it for them for 10 years or whatever. And they can do whatever they can do to exploit that our product in those countries. In 10 years, they give it back to me and then I throw it
out to another.
Back in the AVOD, TVOD, SVOD pool after that's finished. You know what I mean?
So, but how did you, in terms of obviously for all of those platforms to work though, mm-hmm. I guess going back to what you were talking about before, you have to build that audience to find it. Like obviously if it ends up, like I'm not sure how it ends up, you know, landing on the, on your Apple menu when you plug in there. But for mm-hmm. people, or like, for example, for myself, I found this movie like maybe 3 or 4 months ago just by coming across, you know, a trailer for it and going, what the hell? That's Mark Toya? What? Huh? So how did, like, in terms of building that audience, what was your strategy there?
Well, three to four months ago, we launched the trailer. A lot of people go, oh, that's too long. And I go, well, I don't think it's long enough from my advertising days because I know that the world, the media, I mean, the world from a digital perspective is very noisy, right?
Mm.
And it takes a lot of money to cut through that noise or a lot of time. So I thought my 3 months out or 3 or 4 months out actually was a good amount of time because people go, okay, where do I watch it? Where do I see it? Oh, you can't. Oh, geez, I've got to wait till December.
Yeah.
So, who's this? Oh, it's my son. 2 seconds. Hey, Geordie? Yeah, I'm just doing a podcast, mate. Come upstairs or sit downstairs and I'll be with you in a minute.
You're doing a podcast?
Yeah. Come inside and sit down.
No, come you're and join on us. Well, he was part of the crew, wasn't he?
Oh, Jordan, my son. Yeah, no, he was, he was a robot too.
He was a robot.
A bit of comedy for the. Okay, so where were we? So the marketing, this is actually the major part. So you know, putting the movie on platforms, that's not that hard, really.
Mm-hmm.
You know, doing all these deals are not that hard, but marketing your film in a very noisy digital world is very tough. And that's where we go. I figured out we're going to do an organic strategy and a paid strategy.
Mm-hmm.
So I think if you're going to make a movie for $1 million, you want to make sure you've got at least 50 or 100 grand put aside for your digital marketing.
Yeah.
Because no one's going to know this movie exists without it, right? Then you've got to create, then you've got to go through a big PR hype type thing, which you've got to pay for. Pushing it out to all the YouTube guys, hype online sites, everyone, give people screeners and get that hype machine working. And the good thing about it, this particular film, and it's another reason why I went for a robot movie, is because robots, you don't see a lot of robot movies. It's a very...
Oh, that's true. Yeah, I've never thought of it. I've never jumped on, you know, sat down there with Netflix or whatever and gone... Where are my robot movies? But you're 100% right.
Yeah.
There was a gap there and you filled it. Yeah.
And I was like, okay, so horror, thriller, action, robots. Okay, so now putting a robot on a thumbnail, the big thing too, the thumbnail became a huge factor of our marketing push. That little thumbnail that people see in YouTube, and that's an impression, right? So whether it's in Facebook, Instagram, or YouTube, that impression... Even though people might not press it, it becomes a thing stuck in their brain, right?
Yeah.
So you've noticed in a lot of my posters and all that, we've used one where we're sort of looking up at the robot holding a gun.
Yeah.
But that one resonated the most. So we did a lot of testing with our posters, and that one kept coming to the top all the time. So that became our with a lot of, you know, people testing of our robots, that became a really solid one that kept working, and as well as a really close portrait head front on shot.
Yeah.
So we use those primarily in our marketing and our thumbnails and our impressions. So then once we started doing and then the trailers were really designed as well. We did a few test trailers, one with a lot of talking in it and a lot of exposition, and then one that was just explosions and fucking guns and robots flying around. And what we did, we realized people didn't really want to know about the story. They just want to watch something cool.
Yep.
So there's some people that go, oh, I don't really know what the story's about. And there's other people going, oh, now I've seen the whole movie. You know, there's always someone whinging about the trailer, right?
Yep.
So after we did a few trailers, we realized the ones that were working, and then we just slowly got rid of the rest. And then we, and that's when we put up that major trailer that from 3 or 4 months ago. And then we did a second trailer, which was even more action-focused and a little bit shorter. And then we started going into our paid stuff, which we only did once we noticed the organic stuff was starting to slide, is then we started to push our paid media into Facebook and Instagram and Twitter and all that sort of stuff. And, and we're about to hit YouTube pretty hard this year as well. So, and the here's the crazy thing. We've only literally spent about $6,000 or $8,000 at the moment out of
what?
So our organic reach has been amazing. Our
that fans is incredible. Have
really built amazing. And with our $6,000 or $8,000 or $10,000, I'm not sure what it is at the moment, whatever that amount is now, we've reached out our paid amount. I think we've had several million views of people actually wanting to press the button and watch it.
Yeah, that's insane.
And then
that's
we drive people to any one of those platforms, you know.
What strikes me as interesting about this is how you're fiddling with the dials. You know, you're trying something and then revising it and refining it. That's really hard to do. It's really hard to hire that out. It's easier to do that when you're on the pulse of it and you have access and the skills to make those changes yourself or to drive those changes yourself. Don't you think?
Yeah. Oh, very much so. And the good thing about social media now, this, you know, once you get into the social media managers within these programs, you can really get down. So we did a few paid tests to see who our market was, and it came in that between 27-year-old to 39-year-old males, 92%, red hair, drive Camaros, you know. Okay, I'm getting too filly now, but you can really nail down to exactly that demographic.
Yeah.
You know, what they own, what they pay, what they're interested in, the movie styles they're after. You can really dig into those things and just target them, so you're not wasting your 1 cent on the old granny in Nebraska. Do you know what I mean? You're really targeting it on that one person that may watch your movie. And if they don't watch your movie in TVOD or PVOD, they'll probably watch it in streaming. And if they don't want to watch it in streaming because they haven't got $14 to pay Netflix for the year, they'll go and watch it on PVOD for free.
Yeah. So you'll get
somewhere down the line.
Yeah. And do you ever, was it also part of your plan to start building specific trailers? Like you were mentioning before, okay, well, we had a trailer that went off to a horror site, or like, are you going to be making segmented trailers for those segments on social media as well? So where, you know, let's make one for the guys that are 27 to 39. Let's make one for the girls who are, you know, med students. Yeah, I don't know. Let's make
If there was a med student one, we'll go for that. That's right. Yeah. We're completely designing on the go. So what we're doing, I'm literally evolving the trailers every few days, actually. And so we see the feedback online and on our, again, in the social media managers, you get to see, well, that one, only 250,000 people looked at that one, but this one, 900,000 people looked at that one.
Yeah.
Then we looked at why. And then we go, well, okay, let's do another one. We'll use this, the base of that one, and we'll use our data that we got from YouTube and Apple and all that, and go, well, we were number one on Apple for a whole 2 days. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
And now we don't need to lie now. We can actually say it. Let's put Apple number one.
Yes, Apple number one. Yeah,
we can. You know what I mean? Because it happened. So Apple number one and Google Play number one and YouTube number one and all that sort of stuff. And that really took off, you know, because people now are going, it was number one? All right, so now we're riding off the hype of this thing, you know what I mean?
Yeah, yeah.
And then, you know, people and testimonies, people love those things, you know, because it's someone else vouching for you. You know, we're still 5 stars on Google Play, and, you know, Tenet is 4.5. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
So sort of like, I'm not even sure. I haven't even looked at these. I was on holidays having a couple of drinks with Matt up on the island there.
So, Hamo.
I hope he didn't let out of the bag. Maybe he wasn't supposed to be away.
No, I was. It's all good.
I'm just in there now, just at movies. Let's see more. So movie genres. There we go. Genres. I'm just going to go to science fiction just for the hell of it. Action adventure. There you go. So we're still number 5 on the top shelf of popular action adventure movies.
That's great.
That's incredible.
And we're number 2 in action adventure. I mean, number 1 in sci-fi. So it's still hanging in there. Action thriller movies were number 2 next to Tenet.
Once again, mixing all the genres has bought you something, Mark.
Yeah, that's right. Because all these other movies in science fiction, they're all family movies, right? There's Avengers. Yeah. Tremors, Jurassic Park, Sonic, Spider-Man, Wonder Woman, and Tenet. They're the ones I'm sitting in. So I'm the only R-rated one there at the moment. But anyway, overall, it's all going to plan and probably going a little bit better than I thought it would. And I'm quite happy sharing this info with people because I want all filmmakers to learn by my mistakes, as I have.
Oh, no, look, I was just going to ask, and obviously, no, don't answer if you don't want to, but what was the budget?
$1.6 Australian million dollars.
Wow, that's amazing.
Yeah,
You've done that for that kind of money. That is that's incredible.
You, I didn't pay myself, right, so it's not really fair, but that's the real cash we burnt.
Yeah, yeah.
And everyone got paid except for me. So, you know, all the actors, all the 3D people, all the locations, everyone got paid. All the crew,
yeah.
They all got paid what they wanted, and so I don't owe a cent to anyone, and I'm quite proud of that.
Yeah, so it should be.
About me trying to recoup now.
Normally, the metric is how many visual effects houses you put out of business to finish your film. So this is this is good.
Look, I'm a big supporter of visual effects post houses, and I know how they work and why they work and how they make money, right? Because I'm very, I know the way they make money, and they're supposed to be able to do it this way. And I practically did it the same way they would do it, right? Because most post houses do farm a lot of work out, you know, to places throughout Asia, Russia, India, all that sort of stuff, you know. So I pretty much did it the same way. But what I did is my decision-making in post-production is so much faster. Like I've got friends that work on a lot of Marvel movies, for instance, and they might have one shot with 30 guys on it and they might go back and forth to the shot 100 times.
Yeah.
Or I can get my shot approved in 2 or 3 times.
Or maybe one time. Yeah.
And from because I did a lot of compositing on this movie as well, is I didn't have to argue. All I did was argue with myself. Right. So the thing was, you know, that the artist knew as well, because we threw everything through Frame.io, is when they saw that little green button, then they were going to get paid. And they were keen as hell to see that little approve button turn on. And they knew that I knew post-production as well, and they couldn't pull any silly tricks.
Yeah, yep.
So, you know, it was a case of I'm happy to pay is, but let's make sure that the model is amazing, make sure that everything, the lighting, because we set up the lighting for them, a lighting system, you know, my visual effects supervisor, Rael Teague, that I employed just for the job, and him and I designed the lighting type plan that went off to other guys that did lighting. We designed the way we were going to composite it. We didn't do multi-layers of 3D that came in as like 20 or 30 layers. We just made one single EXR file that we rendered perfectly in the box that would fit directly into our scene, and all we had to do was grade it, which saved thousands and thousands of hours. But yeah, just made it a perfect 3D model.
Yeah, and saved you thousands and thousands of dollars as well. That's smart.
Actually, the price we got, you know, from multiple shops was between $2 to $3 million. And we did all the post production for our movie for $485,000.
Yeah.
Wow. Right. Well, it looks like $1 million, as they say.
Hopefully it brings you a lot more because, it looks stunning, stunning. Yeah,
thanks for that. Well, you know, like I said, I didn't have the pressures behind me, so I had no excuse, right? And, you know, a lot of directors, they've got literally a fist up their ass most of the way through making movies. They've got to jump a lot of hoops, they've got to spin a lot of plates, and they've got to talk to a lot of people that don't need to be spoken to, right? And they are pressured from one end of that project to another. For me, I didn't have any pressure at all. So there was no excuse for me not to do a good job. You know, the more pressure you put on a director, the fucking worse he's going to do.
Yeah.
Right? He can't do what he's great at because he's got 10 other directors standing behind him, you know what I mean?
That's cool. With
different labels.
Yes. Yeah.
No, well, I am cognizant of your fading time here, Mark.
And your son sitting downstairs.
Yeah. He's going to have a bit of dinner with me, which is nice.
where can people watch Monsters of Man?
At the moment, everywhere. Apple TV, Google Play, YouTube Movies, Amazon. Blah, blah, blah. Yeah, there's tons of them. So it's not hard. Just type it in the Google, into your browser, you'll find a watchable version. You know, Vimeo On Demand, everywhere. It's like literally everywhere.
Where's the best place for people to follow you personally, to follow your work and to stay in touch with what you're doing?
Look, I put a lot of stuff on Instagram. Instagram, just Mark Toyer at Instagram, you'll find me pretty easily.
Dean, what's your Instagram or social following handles?
It's Frisky Said Like Whiskey with an A.
Cool.
On Instagram.
I'm signing in now.
And I'm M. Jepsen, M-J-E-P-P-S-E-N at Instagram. That's probably the quickest way. Yeah. Thank you again, Mark, for making the time. Thank you, Dean, for your insightful questions and for co-hosting this. And hope to chat with you guys again soon.
Yeah, thanks, man. That's great.
Thanks, Matt.
And it was good to see you.